Welcome back to Against the Grain. My name is Dr. Samir Kakodkar. I'm a gastroenterologist and specialist in ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. If you have any questions about this podcast or want to make an appointment or talk to me about specifically your case, you can send me an email at samir3@gmail.com. That's samir3@gmail.com. Okay, thank you for tuning in today. I actually do not have a guest. I'm going to be speaking just by myself to you guys. And the topic of conversation is diet and Crohn's and colitis. I'm going to be speaking a little bit about my research, the research I've done so far, and also how to manage doing the diet along with medications. I think there's a big kind of hole in the knowledge base of, you know, you have a group of people who are really pro-diet, a group of people who are really pro-medication, and I kind of want to bridge that gap. I want to bridge that and give you a framework of how to think of these things. As of the recording of this podcast, I have no conflicts of interest to report. I do not get any funding from any pharmaceutical company. I don't do research for them. And I also don't have any conflicts of interest to report from any kind of dietary side either. I'm really just giving you my honest opinion based on my training, based on all the patients I've seen, and just what I've observed. I'm just being trying to be as real as I can with you guys. So, you know, I did do a fellowship in inflammatory bowel disease where I only saw, I mean, pretty much completely Crohn's and colitis patients for a whole year. I worked with a very famous gastroenterologist. His name is Dr. Stephen Hanauer at Northwestern. Learned a lot from him along with his team. And kind of learned the conventional way to treat inflammatory bowel disease, which was a very valuable experience. So just from seeing a lot of IBD patients and seeing them go through the treatments and how they did, I've learned a few things, and these are just kind of my overall words of wisdom from going through that whole experience, you know, both a GI fellowship and an inflammatory bowel disease fellowship. So that was a total of 4 years of training. So I really like the quote from Socrates where he says, "The only true wisdom is knowing you know nothing." And so whenever I hear anybody saying they have the ultimate cure for Crohn's or colitis and it's going to work in everybody, you know, I automatically start to doubt their credibility. Because if you really see a lot of these patients, a lot of people with this suffering, with this condition, you know that sometimes one thing will work in one person and another, and that same thing tried in an otherwise similar disease won't work at all. So you just kind of have to be humble about it. And there isn't one intervention, like I said, that's going to help everybody, and that includes dietary therapy. I've seen plenty of patients who get a very rapid and good response to diet, and plenty of them that don't have any response to it at all. And you just have to accept that these diseases, though they're called Crohn's disease, if you have two patients with Crohn's, I really believe that they are actually different as far as what inputs are driving the inflammation, what the disease is going to look like over time. They're different. And as a result, it may require different treatment or combination of treatments to get that disease process under control. So that my philosophy is attacking inflammation from multiple angles. And what that involves is different according to each patient and their individual circumstances and what their disease looks like and their history. And I kind of come up with a tailored plan for each patient. And then usually most of the time involves a combination of medical therapy and dietary therapy, because I just think the outcomes are not that great overall for people who just do medicine. And then beside the rapid responders, I think the overall course is much more comfortable and it's a better quality of life when you do diet with medication. But certainly there are people who are rapid responders to diet and that's worth doing if it's definitely, if it's making you feel better and decreasing the inflammation. So regarding the mechanism of action, there's a lot of drugs that are approved for Crohn's and colitis by the FDA. And I'm not going to get into the specifics about all of them because there's plenty of them. It's even amongst gastroenterologists, it's difficult to keep them all in your head. Now, I have to keep on top of it because that's my subspecialty. So I'm up to date with everything. But there's a lot of medicines, and they come in the form of pills, infusions, injections, and it's pretty complicated as far as how GIs decide what's right for you. But all of those medicines, at least the ones that are approved now, target the immune system, the dysregulated immune system. And that comes in the form of medications that bind to cytokines or these proteins that are kind of like the alarm system and turn on the immune system. And they work on that side. So on the one side of the gut epithelium, or these cells that line your gut. And another one is by targeting trafficking, immune cell trafficking, so that your white blood cells don't get into the tissues. So there's a lot of medicines now. But there isn't much that's approved right now that works on the other side of the epithelium. And we're talking about mainly is the microbiome. We know the microbiome, which is a term for the bacteria, the microorganisms in the colon or in the GI tract, and we know that they are not as diverse. There isn't much of a diversity in the type of bacteria that's there compared to people who do not have Crohn's and colitis. So yeah, there isn't anything targeting that. It's just on the immune system that's kind of reacting to that less biodiverse microbiome. So, but one thing that potentially could target that is diet. You know, there is some data, and I'll go over my research a little bit later, but that it may help to increase the biodiversity of the microbiome. There are antibiotics. Antibiotics are sometimes used in Crohn's, but that really decreases the biodiversity potentially even further, and the long-term consequences of that are unknown. And those aren't things you can take really long-term. They don't tend to really work long-term. So that's where diet fits into this whole puzzle, is that it may just be another mechanism we can target. And another concept I wanted to talk to you guys about is this N=1 trial. So randomized controlled trials are what are required to approve medications by the FDA, and that's when they take one group of patients with in this circumstance Crohn's and colitis. Well, they get a group of patients with Crohn's and colitis, and they pretty much randomize them, which means it's the equivalent of flipping a coin. And based on that, either they get the active drug or a placebo. And after determining certain outcome measures, like how they're feeling and looking at inflammation, if the people who get the drug compared to the placebo, if they're better and it's statistically significant, then it's considered effective. And that's really the gold standard way to determine if a medicine works. But theoretically, there could be a subgroup of patients in such a trial that did get better, but because you're looking at the whole trial, everybody in the trial, it may not show up as statistically significant. So then it's still considered ineffective, even though that small group of patients may have benefited. It's also important to keep in mind that in these clinical trials, they enroll patients with the label of Crohn's disease, but they all likely have different things that are driving their inflammation. So it's possible that subsets of these, if this group called Crohn's disease, are getting a benefit, but if there's no difference in placebo, they'll say the treatment doesn't work for anybody. So that's the pitfall. And when you have a treatment that is potentially, that doesn't have much of a downside that we know of, and it's something you can try relatively easily, I say, why not? So I think diet is worth a shot for most of my patients. And I usually say to give it a month just to see how they're feeling and see if it's affecting inflammation. And then that's what's important. It's the patient that's important. If you're feeling better, then that's why you come to see a doctor, to feel better. It's not about all this theoretical stuff. if it's going to perform well in a randomized controlled trial. What we know about diet is there's definitely a lot of people who say it works. There's definitely at least case reports of people showing that it heals the colon and may address inflammation. Although the evidence is still considered weak, I still think it's worth doing because there isn't much of a downside, and it potentially can help people. So what does the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation say about diet? And, you know, the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation, as of 2012, on their website, they pretty much say that still there's no specific foods that worsen the inflammation of inflammatory bowel disease. They pretty much say that certain foods can aggravate symptoms, but nothing can make the inflammation itself worse. And then there's the question, is there a special diet for inflammatory bowel disease? And they pretty much say no. They just want you to, the key point is to strive for a well-balanced, healthy diet. So, but the question is, like, what is a healthy diet? There's so much controversy now, and if that's not going to directly influence the inflammation in your bowel, I guess you're just doing it just for your overall health so you don't die of heart disease or cancer. But even then, like, what is the appropriate diet for even just being healthy? You know, some people say, oh, it's the Mediterranean diet, it's the DASH diet. Every year they like kind of rank these diets, but it is a very controversial subject. Some people say low carb, some people say low fat, and you could find evidence to support all of these things. I think the common denominator is getting the processed food out. And then I just had one comment about the Mediterranean diet. You know, is it really the diet? And I'm sure part of it's the diet, but part of it's the Mediterranean lifestyle, the environment. They tend to spend more time outdoors. They have more of a sense of community. All of these things have influences on your longevity and your health. So it may not just be diet itself. But again, as of 2012, the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation, their general recommendations or eat smaller meals at more frequent intervals, reduce greasy fried foods, limit milk or milk products if lactose intolerant, and restrict high-fiber foods, nuts, seeds, corn, popcorn, and various Chinese vegetables. Again, this is based on no data, again, anecdotal, and they acknowledge this is not expected to really affect the disease course of inflammatory bowel disease, but I guess these are just rules of thumb based on clinical experience. You know, they go as far as even saying that eating a, you know, fast food may be okay, like a hamburger or a milkshake. So I don't take much stock in what the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation website says about diet, because I think they're a little bit behind when it comes to what patients know and what the researchers in this field know. Next, I wanted to go over my research on the SCD. You know, when I started doing research when I was a medical student, and I've been doing that kind of research for several years now, and just go through kind of the progression of what I've figured out. You know, for a while, breaking the vicious cycle had this theory, like Elaine Gottschall had this theory that food was having an effect on the microbiome, and it was. But as far as what that effect was, we didn't know, and there was really no proof that it was having an effect. There was some general studies showing that food had an influence on microbiome, but specifically the SCD, I was curious to know what was actually happening. So the first abstract I published, this was several years ago, and if you want to Google it or look for it, it's the effect of the SCD diet on gut bacterial fingerprints and IBD. And I don't want to go into all the specifics of it, but pretty much we took 10 patients on the SCD compared to 8 patients not on the SCD, all with inflammatory bowel disease, both Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. We did this 16S rRNA analysis, which is pretty, basically it's looking at the microbiome. And we found that there were two subjects with ulcerative colitis who had a significant difference in their microbiome composition compared to the controls. We saw that more in the ulcerative colitis and not so much in Crohn's. So that was the initial finding, and that was published in abstract form. And then that was followed up by another abstract This and if you want to search for this one, it's the bacterial microbiome of IBD patients on the specific carbohydrate diet. And there we increased the amount of patients. And you know, some of you who are listening may have participated in this study, which I greatly appreciate. But there's a whole story behind, you know, how this study started and all the hurdles I had to go through to even get this study going. But pretty much people throughout the whole country were, you know, I'm very grateful to them. I had put out an advertisement and on different message boards and websites and got a very, very robust response from people who wanted to participate in this research because they believe so much in the SCD and wanted to finally see some research being done. So these were some of the first studies done. There was a case report that was published previous to these findings. But overall, these were some of the first studies to come out in peer-reviewed literature. So in this second study, we had more patients. And these patients pretty much mailed their stool and urine samples, and filled out these very detailed surveys about what they were doing. And so we had 20 patients with IBD on the SCD compared to 20 controls with IBD not on the SCD following an otherwise Western diet. And pretty much the conclusion was that they may have a more biodiverse microbiome, at least according to one of the metrics we used. And these differences were more notable this time in Crohn's disease than in ulcerative colitis. Now, I've always said that I believe dietary therapy works better in Crohn's. This is more in line with my clinical experience. And, you know, I've watched videos of Elaine Gottschall talking about the specific carbohydrate diet. And in her experience, it was more with ileal Crohn's. And even if you read other books, like if you read Life Without Bread by Wolfgang Lutz, he is a proponent of a low-carbohydrate diet, less than 72 grams of carbohydrates a day. And his experience in inflammatory bowel disease, I believe in Germany, was similar in that he definitely saw a better response in Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. And we even see that with elemental diet, right? Elemental diet or polymeric diets, which are these like any kind of formula you drink, those are effective in inducing remission in Crohn's, but not in ulcerative colitis. So I just think overall Crohn's is a more microbiome-driven disease, and that's why we use antibiotics for Crohn's too. So that's why I think diet, I'm more willing to use diet, or I'm more confident that it's going to work in them. But the issue is that it's difficult to diagnose people, right? I mean, there's some people where it looks endoscopically just like ulcerative colitis. We do biopsies, it looks like ulcerative colitis. And some of these patients, unfortunately, require surgery. And even on the colectomy specimen, even looking at the pathologist looking at the whole colon still calls it ulcerative colitis. And there is a small percentage of patients who end up actually having had Crohn's. And there's Crohn's in the small intestine on the ileostomy later on, like years later. So that's why I'm more willing to use diet in everyone, even if you have ulcerative colitis, because you may be misdiagnosed and you may have Crohn's. And there are definitely people, you know, I think it's a smaller number, but people who have ulcerative colitis with a confident diagnosis, and they do respond. So I don't discount it. If somebody's willing to do it, definitely by all means do it. So overall, with those findings, it seemed like the mechanism of the SCD was, at least in the breaking the vicious cycle, it was likened to the elemental diet, right? Elaine Gottschall talks about how the mechanism may be similar. But there's a few issues with that, in that elemental diet talks about more protein structure. Like, that's a formula that only has amino acids, where the proteins are completely broken up into the simplest elements. But the specific carbohydrate diet's not an elemental diet. It's something that it's a monosaccharide diet for the most part. The sugars are single sugars. They're not double sugars or polysaccharides. They're multiple sugars strung together. So it's not the same thing. And elemental diet, we know from research using elemental diet, that it reduces the biodiversity of the microbiome, But my research suggests that SCD actually increases the biodiversity. So they work in different ways. But then you may think, oh, why would that work? Why would reducing the biodiversity of the microbiome work for elemental or polymeric formulas? So it's likened to the effect of antibiotics. We don't know why, but for some reason, both decreasing and increasing the biodiversity from where it is at baseline when you have Crohn's or colitis may help the disease process. But in my opinion, diet, with increasing the biodiversity, it seems like you're going in a better direction and may have a more long-lasting effect than going the opposite direction with antibiotics or potentially the LML diet. And I just want to briefly describe polymeric diet. Polymeric diet is where it's just pretty much formula, and there's no issue with breaking the protein structures down to the simplest amino acids. It's stuff like Boost, Ensure, those are considered polymeric formulas. And those actually work as well as elemental formula and actually taste a lot better too. So if anyone out there is considering doing a formula to induce remission in Crohn's, you might as well do polymeric because it tastes much better. I've tasted both, and elemental formula tastes terrible. It's a very bitter taste. Ensure or Boost are more tolerable. These formulas have a lot of, honestly, crap in them as far as sweeteners. Like, I think Ensure uses high fructose corn syrup and a lot of preservatives and things like that. So it's not like the best for you, but you can't deny that they work. There's very strong research that stuff does work when you drink that exclusively, maybe with water as well. So it's weird, right? Like, why would the SCD increase the biodiversity of the microbiome? Why would it make it more biodiverse? It's a more restrictive diet, right? But actually, in reality, it's a more diverse diet compared to what people eat in a regular Western diet. Because if you look at the processed food out there, a lot of it is made of the similar types of ingredients, right? Like a lot of corn, soy, high fructose corn syrup, wheat flour. I mean, it's stuff that's nutrient deplete. They have to put vitamins in it so people don't get vitamin deficient. And it's just different variations on the same theme when you're talking about, just look at the ingredient label of a Twinkie or a Ho-Ho or like some Wonder Bread or macaroni. I mean, you're going to see a lot of the same stuff. But those kind of foods don't become an option anymore, and you have to eat fruits, vegetables, nuts, you know, meat, you suddenly get a more nutrient-dense diet, and you're eating more of a variety of foods than you otherwise would realize. And I think that's what's going on. That's part of the reason why the SCD increases the biodiversity. You're giving the bacteria more substrate to work with. So, and I do have a publication that's in press. It's been submitted, and, you know, hopefully it gets published soon, but I just wanted to share some of the preliminary results of this. And so we ended up doing a more detailed microbiome analysis on the actual bacterial strains and what may be, and if those strains are really influencing the disease process. And so what we saw is we did something called principal coordinate analysis, which is this kind of graphical representation of what the bacteria, what the microbiome looks like. And what we saw is that there's definitely groupings. The specific people on this specific carbohydrate diet, they group together their bacteria. It looks similar, and that's not surprising. That's not surprising to see, because people tend to eat the similar types of foods. But it was actually more striking that the grouping was more striking in Crohn's compared to ulcerative colitis. And that goes along with what I was saying, is that I think just Crohn's is more of a disease process that's more responsive to diet than ulcerative colitis. The other finding we came across, which was very interesting, was that, again, we looked at the actual bacteria this time in these same 20 patients on SCD with IBD compared to 20 patients with IBD on a Western diet. And what we saw is that there were certain genuses of bacteria which were more represented in the SCD group. And what's important is there were certain ones that were associated with a decreased fecal calprotectin. Right, we did check fecal calprotectin on the stools, and these particular bacteria were increased in the SCD group, and also these particular strains correlated with a reduced fecal calprotectin. So that's pretty strong indication that, I mean, it's not causality, right? We don't have proof that these bacteria are causing the decrease, but it is correlated, and it could be a clue and a sign that we need to study this further. So the particular strains, and this may not be important because you're not going to find a probiotic, at least that's out there right now, that has these, but maybe a good idea. Acillospira lacnosporaceae, an unclassified lacnosporaceae, a Clostridialis unclassified genus, and as well as Lacnospira. Lacnospira being a key one. So those four were more represented in the SCD group and associated with the reduced fecal calprotectin, a very important finding. And then we also saw a particular strain that was higher in the control group, again, the patients not on the SCD, associated with an increased fecal calprotectin, and that was a Streptococcia genus. And kind of the final finding of this study was we saw that We actually checked the short-chain fatty acids. We measured that in the fecal samples. So one of the knocks on the SCD amongst gastroenterologists is they don't see why it would help IBD, because the fuel source of the cells in the colon are these short-chain fatty acids. And they're produced by bacteria metabolizing carbohydrates and producing these short-chain fatty acids. And those have immunomodulatory effects. They're the fuel of the colon cells. So to deplete somebody of carbohydrates traveling to the colon may lead to decreased short-chain fatty acids. However, what we found is that the SCD group had higher butyrate levels compared to the control groups. And there was a statistically significant positive correlation between butyrate levels and one of those genuses of bacteria that I mentioned, the Lacnospira. So very important message there, in that based on these findings, I think the likely mechanism of why the SCD works is that it increases the biodiversity of the microbiome, as I mentioned. It increases the bacteria of genus Lacnospira, which is associated with an increased butyrate production, and also other bacterial species which are associated with the decreased fecal calprotectin or decreased inflammation. But I also think, you know, one of the things that was not mentioned in the Breaking the Vicious Cycle, I think may be at play, is that the SCD decreases food additives that lead to dysbiosis and disrupt the gut barrier. And I think there's a combination of things, and there's probably other things we're not even thinking about. You know, one of the other things that may be going on is maybe you're just getting, again, more nutrient-dense food, and it's just nourishing your body better, and your immune system is working better because of that. And that's another way. So I can think of many different ways of why the SCD may work. Another thing is placebo. Placebo is powerful. And I'm not saying that the reason diet works is from placebo, but placebo can have an additive effect to these other mechanisms. You know, whenever you're heavily invested in something and you believe that something is going to work for you, it's more likely to work. And there's been a lot of studies on placebo effect, and generally placebos don't lead to actual physiologic healing. Like, for example, healing of the colon. It can help with pain and kind of these subjective outcome measures, but actual healing of the colon and decreasing inflammation, it doesn't tend to help with that. And we know there at least there's some indirect low quality evidence that maybe the SCD can decrease inflammation. Another study I published was a case series. So with these same group of patients, they filled out these really detailed surveys of how they were following the diet, what they were doing, and this was just a treasure trove of data, because I had this idea of, why don't I just find, based on the symptom scores, the patients who are in remission, and let's just see what they're doing. Like, how are they implementing the diet? And just their characteristics and what's going on. And this has never been done. Like, when you read about up until this was published, all this only sources we had were Amazon, right? Amazon.com or other book reviews or message boards. So you didn't know, did these people actually have Crohn's or colitis? Or were they just maybe diagnosing themselves, or were they not diagnosed with colonoscopy? You know, even I see patients all the time in clinic who are confused between the difference between inflammatory bowel disease and irritable bowel syndrome. A lot of people think those are the same thing. So, you know, to trust online reviews, for me, I wanted something more concrete. So all of these patients had their diagnosis confirmed by colonoscopy. They sent us their colonoscopy reports. They sent us their pathology reports. We reviewed them and confirmed they had an inflammatory bowel disease. So we had that going. And then I just took all the people, and I found 50 people. It's a huge case series. That's a lot of patients for a case series who had Crohn's or colitis with confirmed diagnosis in clinical remission. Not endoscopic remission necessarily, but clinical remission, and they were on the diet. And we described what we found. So there were 36 patients with Crohn's disease, 9 with ulcerative colitis, and 5 with indeterminate colitis. Mean age was 36 years old, 58% were female. And not surprisingly, as far as reported reasons for going on the specific carbohydrate diet, the number one reason was fear of long-term consequences of medications. That was 82% of the cases listed that as a reason. And then going down from there, 64% said efficacy of SCD compared to medications, at least their perceived efficacy, probably because medications weren't working for them. And that's actually the third reason, medication is not effective. And then adverse reactions to medications. So it's a lot of it has to do with experience with medications and perhaps them not working that leads people to get to the SCD. So, and one of the bridges, the gaps I'm trying to bridge is this, again, two camps, medication, pro-SCD. You know, unfortunately, a lot of people get to the SCD after they try a lot of medicines or they're fearful of medicines. But if you do both, you know, not waiting until, you know, you're in really bad shape before doing the diet when potentially it may not work as well. So I think doing both, depending on the patient's circumstances, makes sense for a lot of people. So the most represented subtype, and again, these are patients that were doing well, was colonic Crohn's disease. So in my experience, I know Elaine Goschel says that it's small bowel Crohn's disease. In my experience, and according to my research, it's colonic Crohn's that actually has the best response. And people had a good quality of life. They had low symptom scores on these validated surveys they took. And yeah, they had a high quality of life. As far as the Crohn's disease group, 8 patients were taking immunosuppressives. 1 patient was still on prednisone, but 19 patients were not taking any medications. In the ulcerative colitis group, there were 3 patients taking immunosuppressives, 1 patient still on prednisone, and 1 not taking any medications. And in the indeterminate colitis group, 1 patient taking immunosuppressives, 2 not taking any medications. So as you can see, just looking at the numbers, there's more Crohn's disease patients doing well on the SCD compared to ulcerative colitis or indeterminate colitis. So that's another reason I say that Crohn's may be more responsive. And there's definitely more patients that are so-called medication-free in the Crohn's disease group as well. So out of the 22 patients not taking any medications, so there was 22, 16 had previously been on steroids and stopped them, 3 were able to discontinue anti-TNF biologics, and 5 discontinued 6-mercaptopurine and remained in remission. So that's, you know, those may be potential indicators of relatively moderate to severe disease if you've been on steroids and biologics and immunomodulators and still have were able to maintain remission without medications afterwards. So as far as the details, and this is what I was really interested in, is like just questions like how many people actually eat yogurt? You may have spoken to different people on the SCD who were tolerating yogurt, were not, were using goat milk or making yogurt out of coconut milk or, you know, various different workarounds. But overall, 88% of the subjects ate the SCD yogurt and 67% ate it daily. So the, you know, vast majority of people using that, and a lot of people, 52% reported using a supplementary probiotic. And those tend to be, you know, the usual ones, Lactobacillus acidophilus and Saccharomyces boulardii. There was a 95.2% adherence to the diet amongst these subjects. And actually, 32.1% were able to occasionally eat forbidden foods. And as far as who those patients were that are able to occasionally go off the diet, 14 with Crohn's, 2 with indeterminate colitis, and 7 of those were taking some sort of maintenance medication, which may have maybe allowed them to do that. It's unclear if exactly that's the reason. But all of those people who were able to occasionally eat forbidden foods were eating yogurt and following the diet for at least 8 months. So these people weren't, you know, venturing out of the diet. They'd been on it for a decent amount of time before trying to do that. The mean time for prepping food was about 10.8 hours per week. The range was from 0 hours to 32 hours. And the mean time to some improvement in symptoms was 29.2 days. Now, I don't know if that is influenced by reading the book, because that's pretty much what the book says. In a month, you should see some improvement in symptoms. But at least it seems in line with the book. Either they're just following that and perceiving it because it was written in the book that way, or it's true. And 66% of the patients had complete symptom resolution at a mean of about 9.9 months. So 9.9 months is when most people, if you're going to get completely better, notice that that happens. But again, I've spoken to plenty of people where they stuck on it 1, 2, 3 years into it, and that's only when they started to feel better. So if you Google this, this study is actually free for anybody to look through. The title of the study is, this was published in, I believe, 2015 in the Journal of Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. It's called A Specific Carbohydrate Diet for Inflammatory Bowel Disease, a case series. And if you Google this and my last name, it'll come up. And this is actually free. We actually paid for this to be free for everybody to read without a subscription to the journal. And there's actually a breakdown of all the patients, all their characteristics, what medicines they're on. So one of the key points with this is a lot of these patients were on medication. So, you know, and I'll talk about this later, but it's an important point that many people use both together to feel better. And one of my more recent publications was, I was tasked with writing a review paper on diet, using diet and inflammatory bowel disease as a therapeutic option for adults. And this was a very daunting endeavor, because I had read almost all the research there is for diet and IBD. I mean, I have binders full of papers where I've read through them over the years, over the course of probably 8, 9 years now. Probably 10 years. And to synthesize all of that, to go through all of that stuff all over again and kind of boil it down to a document was very tough, but I did do it. I had over 100 references, and it took me, you know, several months to get this done, working, you know, multiple full days a week. Finally got done. It was a very rewarding experience, and through that, I just wanted to share some key points from that review article. And this one's not easily accessible online, although there are some websites that are posting it, but you can feel free to email me. I'll email you a copy of it. But it's called Diet as a Therapeutic Option for Adult Inflammatory Bowel Disease. It was published in 2017 in Gastroenterology Clinics of North America, that journal. So bottom line is, if you don't feel like reading it, and it's probably good reading material if you want something to help you to go to sleep, but the important points are, data on diet and IBD is full of contradictions and sparse in terms of good quality clinical trials. Poor quality, you can find data to see various different things. There's no consistency, really. And that really has to do with, you know, these retrospective studies looking at the association of certain dietary patterns and the onset of inflammatory bowel disease. And it's just all over the place as far as blaming carbohydrates, blaming certain fats, protein. You can find contradictory evidence. There's numerous mechanisms have been put forth to explain how carbohydrates, fat, proteins, and other components can cause or reduce inflammation. So this is one of the refrains of gastroenterologists that are not familiar with diet, is that they can't see how food can decrease inflammation. They can't figure out why that would influence it. But you know, there's tons of at least research in mouse models, and not necessarily in humans, but in animal models, there are reasons how fat influences the immune system, carbohydrates influences the microbiome, proteins is also influence the microbiome. So those, and if you want to get into the real minutiae and detail, you can read this article and I go over all of these mechanisms, but there's tons of at least theoretical ones. So there's definitely a theoretical basis of how diet may decrease inflammation. That is there. There's no question about it. But the question is would diet have an influence on the disease course of inflammatory bowel disease? That is yet to be seen and yet to be proved. Limiting, and as far as the conclusions based on the research that's been done so far, is that possibly limiting omega-6 fatty acids, saturated fat, animal protein, and food additives may be helpful in IBD. And this is mainly based on these association studies, these studies that have shown that certain food components are associated with the development of Crohn's and colitis, but not necessarily intervention studies where you make these adjustments and see if the disease actually gets better. But it's weird because those particular things, like omega-6 fatty acids, saturated fat, animal protein, they are not really restricted in the SCD. So, but there's plenty of people, at least anecdotally, saying it helps them. And we do have some indirect evidence that it may increase the biodiversity of the microbiome. So again, a lot of these contradictions that are hard to figure out why. And I also, in this article, went over all the diets for IBD. You know, I know specific carbohydrate diet is what most people end up finding because that's the most anecdotal success stories behind it. But there's other diets that have been, and this has kind of been like a pet project of mine over the last 10 years, is just familiarizing myself with all of these diets. And the ones that I'm familiar with are the low FODMAP diet, the IgG4 exclusion diet, the semi-vegetarian diet from a study in Japan, the low flex diet, the Paleolithic diet, Maker's diet, vegan diet, Life Without Bread diet, which is the one that's the low-carb diet. So this article has an interesting table where I went through all the books on all these diets and figured out what were the food restrictions and compared all of these diets just to see what are the commonalities, what is why. And I don't doubt the fact that these diets may work in people. Like, I don't think there's one particular diet that is the king of all the diets. It's possible that certain ones may be more effective, perhaps the ones that are a little bit more restrictive than the others, but overall there are some common themes, and I do encourage you to check this article out because I made a table where I compared all of these diets, all the restrictions, and you can kind of see where they differ, how they're similar, and generally they take processed food out. That's the basic message. All of these things take the crap out of the diet. And the subtle differences as far as like, oh, does a diet allow, you know, butter or some other component or arrowroot? Like if you look at paleo diet, I think the paleo diet does allow arrowroot, but the SCD doesn't. So like these subtle differences, are they really important? It's tough to say. Maybe they are for certain people. But overall, I think it's good to focus on the commonalities as opposed to how these are subtly different. So yeah, definitely encourage you to check out the article and look at those things. Another way this table can help is if you're on this diet, on one of these diets, and you're maybe feeling well and you're thinking about trying to reintroduce something, why not reintroduce something that's on another diet? That, like, for example, if you're on SCD and you want to expand it a little bit, how about you look at the paleo column and maybe add something that is not allowed on SCD but allowed on paleo, because we know there are at least anecdotally patients who say they benefit from paleo. So that's another way it can be helpful. And then I also go over in this article all the food additives, you know, all the stuff in our food supply that's probably damaging our gut barrier and messing up our bacteria. Things like carrageenan, maltodextrin, polysorbate 80, carboxymethylcellulose. So you can read about how those things are harmful in that article. So next, I want to focus on diet and medicine and how to conceptualize using both. So first of all, how do you bring up the SCD to your gastroenterologist? You know, not everybody's like me where I'm familiar with it and actually implement it. Actually, most people have no clue, will have no clue what you're talking about if you bring it up. If you bring that Breaking the Vicious Cycle book with you to the appointment, odds are they're not going to be familiar and may just say, oh, you can try it if you want, or I don't know anything about it. So the vast majority of gastroenterologists do not utilize the SCD or any dietary therapy, and they've been taught that there's no such thing as an anti-inflammatory diet. And again, they recommend this kind of overall healthy diet, but what that is, we don't really know. So why is this the case? Why do gastroenterologists, has there been this disconnect? Well, I mean, part of it is for good reason, because there's a high burden of proof to change the standard of care. There's a long history of snake oil salesmen, people, you know, trying to push treatments that have no benefit in order to make a profit, et cetera. So that's why medicine is built the way it is now. It doesn't take anything for granted, and it requires a very high standard, high burden of proof in order to recommend treatments on a population-wide basis. And, you know, there's different things like cost that's involved, and you only want to do things that are proven to be effective. But as I mentioned before, there are pitfalls to that approach, like the randomized control trial that I mentioned before. So that's part of the reason. And one of the problems is that, you know, to have that high burden of proof, you need to do these expensive research studies that require a lot of funding, and pharmaceutical companies tend to get more funding than studying something like the diet. But that's starting to change now, which is a good thing. So another reason why GIs feel this way is this is a pearl passed down from one generation of gastroenterologists to the next. And that's just how the training is. I was lucky in that I believed in diet and was researching diet before I even went into internal medicine residency. So though I was being trained in this way, and it was actually a strange situation, I didn't really, it was almost like this cognitive dissonance thing going on, where I did want to be trained as a traditional inflammatory bowel disease specialist. I wanted to be trained in that way just so I was an expert, absolute expert in the medical treatment. So the dietary approach to it, I kept in the back of my mind. I believed in my heart that it worked. But I kind of kept that on the back burner as I learned the traditional way. And though I was being taught that diet had no influence on IBD, I kind of just let that be. And then once I finished my training, now I'm implementing it. But that's just kind of what you have to do. But people who don't have that background, who didn't experience it, or didn't study it, or just weren't interested, if they go through the standard gastroenterology training and the fellowship, they won't believe in diet. And I even the, you know, people I've worked with, colleagues I've worked with, they, you know, I remember one particular instance where I saw a patient with inflammatory bowel disease, and I went over diet with them in the hospital. I spoke with him for like over an hour over the course of 3 days while they were admitted with ulcerative colitis about diet and different options and how it's going to be managed with medicine. And then, as you know, in medicine, you can your colleagues cover for you when you're on call a week at a time. And then apparently they told that same patient that diet has nothing to do with it. And I saw that patient in clinic, and that's what he told me. He's like, the doctor that was on after you told me diet had nothing to do with it. And I said, hey, you know, that doctor is entitled to their opinion based on their training, based on their experience, but I don't feel the same way. We have a difference of opinion, and that's just how I treat it. Another thing is I think it's a pervasive belief that gastroenterologists that diet is a placebo effect predominantly. And I already talked about this, but that doesn't explain how, you know, we have some at least weak evidence to show that it may have an influence on inflammation, which we wouldn't expect with the placebo effect. The IBD field is getting more and more stringent when it comes to proving that therapies work. And they want to see mucosal healing. They want to see the colon or small intestine heal of inflammation and ulcerations before saying something works. And again, that's getting away from that placebo effect. So there's this general belief that diet won't heal the mucosa, and it's going to be risky to put somebody on diet when we have proven therapies that do heal the colon. And so they shy away from using diet. But again, I think that's a mistake, because if you use both, maybe your outcomes would be better. At least research it and see if that's the case. But that I do believe that would be the case. The outcomes would be better by doing both. So, and it's likely this doubt of diet is likely based on clinical experience of seeing some patients fail dietary therapy. I can tell you for a fact that, you know, in a busy GI practice for most gastroenterologists, they're not seeing, like, most of their IBD patients are not interested in diet or not trying it. And they probably, a lot of them are not even familiar with it. So they may have a handful of people that, oh, they came in with a book and they wanted to try diet, and maybe they tried it and it didn't work. But, you know, the specifics of how they implemented it, were they strict enough, were they on it for long enough, et cetera, influences that decision. So just because you have a few patients that didn't respond to diet does not mean it doesn't work. I mean, how many patients, and I'm directly speaking to those gastroenterologists, how many patients have you scoped who've been on Remicade, where you scoped them and it was ulcerations all over the place? How many people have you scoped on Imuran, on Mesalamine, on Entyvio? Are you going to say those medications don't work? Again, it's you're applying a different standard to diet than you are to medications. You know, 30% of patients are non-responders to biologics, and there's about a 10 to 20% loss of response per year. But we still say it works, right? Because there's a subset of patients where it does work. So, and that's part of the reason. So, and another thing is most GIs know nothing about how to implement the SCD. They just don't know. I mean, the real knowledge base exists with the patients, right? It's you guys that it was a mother with a daughter with ulcerative colitis that ultimately wrote this book, and then patients have kind of taken up the mantle to continue the message, and have developed protocols, how to troubleshoot the diet on message boards, et cetera. So I think overall physicians are afraid of things that they don't know. So if you present them with something that they're not familiar with, I guess their attitude is, yeah, I don't know anything about it, so it must not be true. And then I think that's not a great good. They should be genuinely curious. So one of the things I encourage people on the SCD to do, if your gastroenterologist approves of it or not, is to stay in touch. Like, I think there's some people who get substantially better and don't see a gastroenterologist anymore, and I don't think that's doing any, and it's not leading to any benefits as far as this becoming more mainstream. Because, I mean, can you imagine if your GI, if you actually followed through with seeing them despite feeling better and then getting a colonoscopy and it's completely normal, even if you don't want to do medication or whatever. But I think more and more patients who continue to follow through and get colonoscopies or get fecal calprotectins and prove to your GI that this may be working. And then if all of a sudden all these people are doing this and it's working, they have to at least investigate this more and take it more seriously. So, regarding medications, you know, Breaking the Vicious Cycle was published in 1994, and there was, you know, a food in the gut reaction was published before that, and of course, On the Treatment of Celiac Disease was the original book by Dr. Sidney Haas. So before Breaking the Vicious Cycle was published, there weren't many medications available for inflammatory bowel disease. There was prednisone and steroids, there was sulfasalazine and other mesalamine products. There was azathioprine, cirks-mercaptopurine. There was antibiotics, methotrexate, and surgery. There may have been a few other ones, but those were the main ones that were available. But after the book was published, So it's understandable that people were looking for diet because there weren't many medication options available. But since it was published, now there's a ton more medications. So the decision process becomes very complicated, which is part of the reason I'm doing this podcast, is to share with you kind of how these decisions, at least how I make decisions with patients. So after it was published, now there's, you know, there's Remicade, which was the first biologic approved for Crohn's disease in 1998. You have budesonide, kind of like prednisone light, type of steroid with less systemic side effects. You've got adalimumab or Humira. You've got certolizumab, Pagel or Cimzia, golimumab, otherwise known as Simponi, vedolizumab, otherwise known as Entyvio, ustekinumab, otherwise known as Stelara, tofacitinib, otherwise known as Xeljanz, which is one of the newest ones for ulcerative colitis, cyclosporin, tacrolimus, thalidomide, and believe me, there's many more to come, many more to come. So according to Breaking the Vicious Cycle, diet, and this is a direct quote from the book, the diet should be discussed with your physician. Medications should continue as the physician has instructed. As progress is made, the physician undoubtedly will reduce medication gradually. That is unlikely. I'm just putting my editorial into that. And then it says, warning, there are very specific procedures by which certain medications are reduced, and it can be dangerous to discontinue their use improperly. Always seek medical advice in reducing medication. And I definitely agree with that. So key concepts when you're talking about managing diet and medication. Symptoms in Crohn's and colitis do not correlate well with mucosal healing. That's more the case in Crohn's disease than ulcerative colitis, but overall it's kind of a good rule of thumb for both. So you have to be objective in your assessments. You know, if you're doing medication, diet, combination, whatever, over time, you have to be objective. You can't just rely on, oh, I'm feeling better. You got to look at the inflammation. And you have to think about what are your goals with starting the SCD. So is it just that you want to avoid being on medications, or is it your quality of life? And I think quality of life should be the ultimate goal for most people. How effective is the SCD? We don't know. Nobody knows really how, like, what percentage of people, like, if you take all comers, like, what percent are actually going to respond to it? We don't know. So we know that there are some people who do, but what percentage is yet to be determined. Because even my studies, there was some selection bias, right? I mean, we took patients who did well on it, but we don't know what percentage would not have done well. And SCD is just another, or any dietary therapy, is another tool in your toolbox. You got to look at Crohn's and colitis like it's a problem, and it's something that can be fixed, and sometimes you need multiple tools to do it. So, and I personally believe, as I said before, you may need to utilize multiple tools for optimal results. So there's pretty much three clinical scenarios you have to keep in mind when you're starting diet and medication. One of those is having no response at all. You're not getting better. Your inflammation's not getting better. In that case, you have to change course. You have to do something different. Either that's change of medication, make some adjustments to your diet, something like that. Another scenario is having a very good response. You're feeling better relatively rapidly. Your inflammation is coming down. And in that case, I would say if something is working for you, you know, stick with it. If you're on medication and diet, you're going to continue that at least for the time being. But I think the most difficult scenario is actually the one where you're partially responding. You're getting a little bit better, but not completely where you want to be. And so it's a question of which of maybe only diet is helping you, maybe only medicine is helping you. And it's hard to tease that out. So that's the one where it can be confusing and can be a struggle also to figure out if you should be continuing both of these or really what you should be doing from that point. What is the typical scenario for somebody starting the SCD? And again, in my experience, after talking to people at different conferences and patients, it's usually somebody who has active disease, they're refractory to a medical therapy or therapies, and probably on prednisone. A medication is recommended that scares you, and you want control, and you likely find the SCD from the internet, a family member, or friend. That's tends to be what happens. Very common. And often you're getting a lot of pressure from your GI. No, you need to start the medicine. And but maybe you want to do diet by itself. So what are the positives of doing SCD with medical therapy? So there may be synergy. There may, as I said, you know, you're utilizing different mechanisms. And so maybe diet by itself or medication itself wouldn't work as well as doing both at the same time. And it can smooth out this roller coaster as you start the SCD. If you read the book, it talks about having these intermittent flares, maybe induced by the flu early on in the first few months of your diet. And at least anecdotally, I've heard people can sometimes take a few steps back before taking a step forward. And it can be very emotionally exhausting because you're really scrutinizing your diet, trying to figure out why you took a step back, and can sometimes be correct, sometimes be incorrect. You end up restricting your diet needlessly. So all of these things can happen. And if you're on a medicine that's also helping this inflammation, maybe you can not avoid these heartaches that happen. I also believe that if you're particularly sick, you know, if you have significant iron deficiency anemia, you're really fatigued, going to the bathroom a lot, and just need results quickly, I think you should do yourself a favor, get on a medicine that works quickly so that it can, again, work synergistically with the diet and get you on your feet sooner rather than later. There are some people who can't afford to wait that month to get some benefit to the diet, and perhaps up to a year to get the full benefit. So it's just in your interest, if you're particularly ill, to get on medicine along with diet, and your course is going to be a lot more comfortable. Overall, medications are relatively safe. You know, I may be speaking to a select population through these podcasts of people who've not had good experiences with medication, but you know, these would not be approved by the FDA if they had major health concerns associated with them. There are rare side effects. For example, we can take Remicade, right? Remicade, the baseline risk of getting a pneumonia is about 1%. And if you're on Remicade, that risk goes up to 2%. So still, I mean, you can see there's double the risk, but the absolute increased risk is very small. So overall, they're safe if you haven't had an issue with them before. And there is potential to actually de-escalate therapy in certain scenarios, and I'll discuss that a little bit later. You potentially could stop therapy and see how you do. I think in most circumstances, it probably isn't a good idea, but we'll talk about that later. And there's the potential to possibly tolerate more foods if you're on medication. And there's peace of mind for you and your doctor. You know, there's this concept of treat to target, which my mentor instilled in me and is a big proponent of that, is that in Crohn's and in ulcerative colitis, the inflammation leads to progressive bowel damage and can lead to strictures or colon cancer or fistulas or abscesses requiring surgery. And that scar tissue that forms can be permanent and not respond to medication. But if you jump on top of it early, then you can prevent those downstream complications from happening. So it is peace of mind to know that you're attacking the inflammation in every way you can. And it's harder to control inflammation if it's left unchecked. So you need to really get on top of it as early as you can. And those are the people that have the best outcomes. As opposed to, for example, saying, like, if you're newly diagnosed and say, oh, I'm going to try diet first. And then you're on diet for like a year or two and maybe not getting completely better and, you know, maybe wasting time on prednisone, which is not making things better. And then after a while, you start to do medical therapy, and at that point it may not work as well, and then you're in a very tough spot. So what are the negatives of SCD with medications? You know, there are questions about at least for the oral medicines, are there interactions between the illegal ingredients and the efficacy of the diet? And I think from my case series, I showed that there are plenty of people using mesalamine or azathioprine along with the diet and still having success. So I think the benefits outweigh the risks of these small ingredients. Like, I know there are certain mesalamine preparations that have, for example, like wax, caruba wax, or They have lactose as a filler. So, but overall, you know, if you need it, you need it. And even the book says you need to do that. And then there's the dealing with the side effects and hassle of medications. It's a big hassle. It's a big expense. You have to go to these infusion centers or arrange to get shipments of injections, you know, every month or so, and constantly on the phone paying bills. And then the side effects, sure. I mean, there are theoretical side effects for a lot of these that can be serious. They're very rare, but can be serious. And long term, we don't know, you know, what these medications may do when you take them potentially for years or decades at a time. I mean, we have nearly over 20 years of data for at least Remicade, but the some of these other medicines, you know, have come out recently. I mean, we do have longer, like for example, Stelara, a longer term data in other disease processes like psoriasis or psoriatic arthritis. But overall, in IBD, these are newly approved. There's also the stigma of being on medications. It's not a nice feeling to know that you pretty much can't function without going to this place and getting an IV. I mean, it's just mentally disturbing. But I can tell you that over time, that feeling goes away, and you just another part of your life. And then medications may not be efficacious. You know, as I said, there's, you know, if you're doing diet and medicine at the same time, this thought will always go in your mind, like, oh, is it the diet that's really making me feel better? Like, do I really need to be on this medicine? And then you have to make a tough decision. I mean, I think most gastroenterologists will tell you to stay on the medicine. And I can tell you from my experience that most of the time when you're feeling well on diet and medicine, medicine is responsible for some of that, and may potentially it could be more than you anticipate. And then when you get off medicine, in my experience, I've seen that people feel a little bit, they either flare or they can feel, at least what happens is they feel a little bit worse. Although, again, it's sometimes they can feel the same. And again, medicines cost a lot. You know, there are prescription, you know, pharmaceutical programs to get the copays down, but you know, sometimes they cost a lot, and sometimes your insurance just denies you, and you don't even get approved for these medicines. So when would it be appropriate, in my opinion, to do diet by itself? And really, there's no evidence to guide this decision, and a lot of it has to do with your own kind of what you want to do. Because ultimately, any doctor can tell you anything, but what you want to do, and this is what I do in my practice, is I'll make a recommendation to patients. But if the patient wants to do something else, that's fine. I'm a complete believer in patient autonomy. But I want to monitor you, and I'm not going to kick you out of my practice. I know there are certain doctors who do that. But you know, if I'm recommending medicine and diet and you want to just do diet, that is completely up to you, and there's no entity, no government, no physician, no pharmaceutical company that's going to tell you otherwise. I can tell you that it may not be a good idea, but ultimately I'm going to support you with whatever you want to do, but I want to monitor you so that you can make educated decisions in the future and not just based on nothing. So I'm going to monitor you, and I'm going to continue to suggest what I'm going to suggest based on how you're doing. So when would I start SCD on somebody without any medical therapy? I think if you have mild disease with minimal to no symptoms, then it's maybe worth a shot. But if you're somebody with Crohn's disease and you have deep ulcers or perianal fistula or strictures, this stuff's already going on, no, I'm not going to say just do diet. I don't discount the fact that potentially it could work by itself. But it's just the stakes are too high, you know. I would rather do it with medicine just so we get your quality of life back to normal as soon as possible. But the question is, would a patient with mild disease with minimal to no symptoms want to do the SCD, such a restrictive dietary protocol? I think it's doubtful. Those patients may actually do well with some medication that has a good side effect profile. But one thing to keep in mind is that sometimes we don't even treat patients with Crohn's disease who have mild inflammation and no symptoms. We just monitor them and see what happens over time, because about 20% of Crohn's disease patients don't have this complicated phenotype where they get the strictures and perianal fistulas, and using biologic medications may not make sense for that patient population. So then comes the question, which medication to use with the SCD? And you may wonder, how does my GI come up with a particular medication for me? And a lot of times there's an ideal choice, and then there's the reality based on like what your insurance is going to actually cover. You know, I can tell you particularly Medicaid is a difficult one. They tend to want to have patients do this kind of step-up approach from the weaker medications to the stronger medications, no matter what the disease looks like, which is unfair. You know, I've always thought about doing a research study looking at outcomes in Crohn's and colitis based on insurance, if you have Medicaid or HMO or PPO, because that would be pretty sad if, you know, based on your insurance, that's who's getting the safer medicines or the more effective medicines compared to people who don't have good insurance. So which medication to use? So we pretty much make a decision on what medicine to use for you. Foremost, based on your disease, your severity. If you have extra intestinal manifestations of Crohn's and colitis, like joint pains, mouth ulcers. And also based on your history of response to other medications and the side effect profile, and the side effect profile of the medications dictate which one we use. There's no evidence to guide which medications may work the best with the SCD. I have some certain opinions about that, but overall, we really don't have anything to guide that. So what would make sense? Do you take the medication that's most indicated for your current status of the disease? And that's like not even considering diet, that you're going to start diet along with it. Just take the medicine that makes the most sense according to my GI. Or do you take the medication with the best side effect profile, even though it might be less efficacious? Because the thought is, oh, I'm going to be on diet and I just need a little bit of support. Or do you take the medication that I'm most easily able to start and stop? Because there's certain medicines, particularly the infusions, the injections, that are difficult to just start and stop because there's a potential to develop antibodies to the drug. Your body kind of fights the drug and clears it. And that's more with these injection and infusion drugs. So what's the right answer? There is no right answer. I mean, I personally make a decision based after a very extensive discussion with each patient and what makes most sense for them. Another thing is there is a lot of controversy. I want to talk about the sun for 1 second here, because I do believe there is value to getting sun exposure during the day. And this is a loaded statement because there's a lot of physicians who will disagree with me, particularly dermatologists, who think that all sun is bad for the most part. I mean, from my experience, seeing them, interacting with them, is that they want you to wear sunscreen and they don't want you to get any sun exposure. Now, we know vitamin D, having a replete vitamin D, is associated with better outcomes in IBD, may have an effect on the immune system, may have an effect on the microbiome, the gut integrity. And particularly if I have a patient who has a low vitamin D level, it to me suggests you're living an indoor lifestyle. And you're probably not getting much vitamin D through your diet either, but you're definitely not going outside. And I think going outside does influence your microbiome, makes it more biodiverse, just being exposed to the outdoors and not indoors all the time. Also, the sun regulates your circadian rhythm, getting that sun exposure through your eye during the day. And then not having any blue light exposure at night allows you to sleep better and also has effects on the microbiome, believe it or not. So I think the sun is good, and I think it has effects on your body beyond just vitamin D. So if you're going to have that approach of going outside, and I recommend going outside 30 minutes to an hour, weather permitting, for most of my patients with IBD. But some of these medications are not good when you're in the sun. So that's things like sulfasalazine can cause you to have some sun sensitivity. Methotrexate may have some issues. Azathioprine increases your risk of non-melanoma skin cancers, so squamous cell, basal cell carcinomas. Anti-TNF, Remicade, Humira, those types of medicines can increase your risk of small, tiny increased risk of melanoma. And then also Stelara and Xeljanz, these are newer medicines. theoretically, you know, it hasn't been borne out in the clinical trials that there's any skin effects, but based on the way they work, because Stelara affects TNF as well, upstream of TNF, and then Xeljanz theoretically could have some issues too. So if you're going to be one of these people with Crohn's and colitis who's going to make that attempt to go outside more, there's certain medicines that may go in line, which may be okay in the sun, and that is mesalamine. There's really no known interaction with mesalamine and the skin and sun exposure. And also Entyvio, just because it's very targeted to the gut. And so those are two ones that, as a result, you know, in the context of the sun issue, may be better. So just a few words on particular medications. So mesalamines can be effective for mild to moderate ulcerative colitis. We know that. But they're no better than placebo when used for Crohn's disease. They can be used when the inflammation looks superficial, kind of looks like that ulcerative colitis type inflammation. But sulfasalazine, there is some data to show it may have efficacy for induction of colonic Crohn's disease, of mild colonic Crohn's disease, more so for induction than remission. So mesalamine can be used for both, but more so in ulcerative colitis. And we talked about mesalamine. There are some inactive ingredients in it that are not consistent with the SCD, but again, there's plenty of people using it, and as in my case series, I demonstrated they're doing fine on it. What about prednisone? Prednisone overall has the worst side effect profile of any of the drugs, in my opinion. So you should not stop this cold turkey if you've been taking it more than 3 weeks. You know, let's say you're on diet with it, because you can have serious problems. You need to slowly wean off of it because your body gets used to getting steroids exogenously, and then your adrenal glands don't produce it as well. So there's a potential for adrenal insufficiency and adrenal crisis, which can cause weakness, fatigue, low blood pressure, and shock. So you need to get on a tapering schedule prescribed by your gastroenterologist. And you really need to resist the temptation to stay on steroids long term, as far as like waiting for the diet to work, because it's going to cause a lot of side effects that sometimes can be irreversible. Most of them are reversible, but there are a few that can be irreversible. What about biologics? These are these drugs like Remicade, Humira, or Entyvio that are infused in an infusion center or are taken by way of injections. And these are protein-based drugs. They have to be taken on a regular schedule because there's a potential for antibody formation. So pretty much what that means is your body, just like you produce antibodies to an infection, like if you get a bacterial infection and you develop an antibody to it to help it clear it, your body can actually produce these antibodies to the drug, and it'll effectively clear the drug before it can have an effect on your Crohn's and colitis. And that's more likely to happen if you don't stay on a regular schedule. So when you start these medicines, you have to think long and hard about stopping them because you risk that potentially happening. What about immunomodulators? So those are medicines like azathioprine and 6-mercaptopurine. These take a few months to start working. They don't work immediately, so they tend to use it in people who respond to steroids that can buy you some time. The advantage of these is they can be started and stopped without concern for antibody formation or loss of efficacy. But in my opinion, besides steroids, they overall have the worst side effect profile compared to biologics. They're just not as targeted. So they have this very low risk of lymphoma associated with them, as well as skin cancers and pancreatitis. So and also viral infections. So generally, I don't like to use this medicine, or if I do use it, I use it in short term along with the biologic just to boost the effect of the biologic. So what's the million-dollar question whenever you're talking about diet and medicine and you're on both is it the SCD or is it the medications responsible for my improvement? And the question is, does it really matter? Yeah, because the important thing is that your quality of life is good, you're feeling good, you can move on with your life and do what you want to do. And there's really no way to definitively tell if you're on medicine and diet which one is working. And I believe in most cases that it's a combination of both. but it's hard to say like what percentage of your improvement is from medicine or diet, etc. I do recommend an objective assessment of healing when you're starting the SCD and medical therapy. So usually you do that within a couple months if you're not getting better, or at 6 to 12 months if you're getting better. And how long does the SCD take to lead to mucosal healing? I mean, we don't know. So that's why we have to do objective assessments. And we do that with either like a CRP, which is a blood test, a fecal calprotectin, which is a stool test looking for inflammation, or colonoscopy. And realistically, even just with medical therapy, you can only achieve mucosal healing in about 40% of patients. So if inflammation is not getting better or getting worse, medications are not working, and possibly the SCD too, and you kind of have to figure out a different game plan. At this point, what you do with the dietary therapy that you're trying, as far as stopping it or trying something different or continuing it, really is a personal decision. For some people, they want to continue that diet and for a longer period of time and see if they get additional benefit. But overall, for the medical therapy, if by this time you're having persistent or worsening inflammation, something different has to be done. And a lot of times that involves checking drug levels of whatever medication you're on and making adjustments using that information. So I can tell you kind of a protocol that I use in my practice when I start someone on dietary therapy along with a biologic, such as Remicade or something similar to that. So pretty much once those are started, I assess for a symptomatic response. If you do have a response, I tend to get some sort of assessment of inflammation. Usually it's a fecal calprotectin at about 3 to 4 months after starting, just to make sure you're on the right track. But then I'll do a colonoscopy at 6 to 12 months after starting, assuming you're doing well. And, you know, if there's mucosal healing or at least improvement in what the colon looks like or small intestine, then my recommendation is to continue the SCD, or sorry, continue whatever dietary therapy you're on along with the biologic. And I would give it at least a few years before this potential of considering stopping medication, which should only be done in certain circumstances, which I'll discuss a little bit later. But if there is signs of persistent inflammation there, and what I would usually do at that point is check a level of the medication. And based on that level, and if there's antibodies to the medication, I'll make an adjustment, either an adjustment in the existing medication or change the medication. Now, the other scenario is that you start someone on diet and medicine and a biologic, and they get no response at all. And in that circumstance, I would check, again, drug levels and antibodies and make adjustments at that point. And usually I will do that within a couple months' time. And as far as what to do with the SCD in that circumstance, you know, there is the potential that it would just take a little bit longer for that to have an effect. So that's a decision that I leave up to the patient if they want to continue dietary therapy or not, just to see if you continue it a little bit longer, if maybe you'll get a persistent, another benefit from it over time. And in the meantime, we can, you know, play around with your medications to give you that extra help to get you back on your feet. Now, what about de-escalating therapy, the whole question of can I stop my medicine, which comes up a lot, especially if you respond, right? You respond to diet, you're on a medicine that scares you, that has scary side effects. I could have made this very complicated. There's a lot of studies that have been published about this, but one thing to keep in mind is that none of these studies looked at diet. These were all patients who got better on medicine, and then the medicines were stopped, and then they studied what happened after the medicine stopped. None of these people were using diet after stopping the medicine or during medical therapy. So take this with a grain of salt because it's not the particular instance you're in, but there are some key concepts you should be aware of. So these are the key points from the trials. Relapse rates will be higher after stopping medications compared to continuing them, obviously. So what does that suggest? It's that medicines, once you get into remission, it's not curing the disease, it's just keeping it under control. And once you stop medicine, it's likely that it will come back. The longer you're off meds, the higher the rate of the relapse. That makes sense, too. There's a high response rate after reintroduction of the medication. So I know I told you that these infusions, injections, you can develop antibodies. But if you've been on it for a while and you stop it, and after several months you get worse, most people actually recapture response if you restart the medicine. And there's certain protocols on how to actually restart medicine in that circumstance, which your GI will be familiar with. But overall, even with medications like azathioprine or Remicade, you can restart them, and people tend to recapture response. So it's good we have that data, because stopping medicine is not as scary as it once was perceived to be. And if you relapse even after stopping the medication and you're still on SCD, you have to question. You really have to be objective at that point and think that, you know, maybe it was the medicine that was mostly responsible for my remission. So what are the predictive factors? So these are important to know, because if you're feeling better on diet and medicine, there's a few things that would make you question stopping the medicine, because they're associated with more of a relapse. So if you have any signs of inflammation, so if you have an elevated CRP or fecal calprotectin, an increased white blood cell count or neutrophil count, a decreased hemoglobin level, otherwise known as anemia, which could suggest you're leaking blood from an inflamed area in the GI tract and therefore active disease. For some reason, male sex is associated with more of a relapse rate. Upper GI involvement, if you have Crohn's of the, for example, duodenum or jejunum, it's a risk factor. Shorter duration of combination therapy for withdrawal. So I talked about this. Sometimes we use azathioprine and biologics together. So if you're on that combination, if you're on that for a shorter duration, like let's say less than a year before stopping one of them, you're more likely to flare. And then other poor prognostic factors, like having ileal disease, perianal disease, stricturing disease, pancolitis or extensive colitis, meaning the whole colon involved, or beyond the splenic flexure, worse disease control before withdrawal. So if you've had a really tough time controlling your disease, maybe you've required a lot of different kinds of medications, it's probably not a good idea to suddenly stop it when you're finally feeling better. That's pretty much it. And also young age, if you're continuing to smoke and you have Crohn's disease, that's a bad thing. Having elevated IBD serologies. And if you've needed a lot of dose adjustments of your medicines, like if you're on Remicade and required the dose to be increased in order for you to feel better, it's probably not a good idea to stop the medicine. And history of prior surgery. Another kind of concept, and this is a special circumstance, if you're one of these people who's on Remicade or Remicade, Humira, a medication like that, and azathioprine, sometimes we use them together, and there sometimes you can stop one of them, and that's probably a better middle path as opposed to stopping both of them and seeing how you do on SCD. So I would actually check drug levels of both. Check a Remicade level and a level of the azathioprine, which is called 6-TG. And whichever is therapeutic is likely working. So if you have a therapeutic level of Remicade, if you have a good level of Remicade then without antibodies, that one's probably helping you. And if you have a good level of the azathioprine, that one's probably helping you. So if one is not therapeutic, that may be the one to stop. So that may be kind of the middle path as opposed to stopping both. Or you can decrease the dose more with azathioprine than the Remicade. And then once you stop medicine, if that's the approach you're going to use, you should really, again, be very objective with how things go from there. So what I recommend is doing a fecal calprotectin every 3 months. Like do one right before you stop the medicines and then every 3 months. And then that can predict a flare as early as 6 months prior to it happening. So then if you start to see that creep up and get into the abnormal range, you know you got to go back on medicine.
So these are the take-home points for de-escalation of medical therapy when you're also doing dietary therapy.
Is only consider de-escalation of medical therapy if you have no evidence of active disease and no bad risk factors. Check a fecal, and I've seen people who
who actually had completely healed their colon. They were on SCD and Remicade or another medicine, completely healed their colon, normal biopsies, none of these bad risk factors. They stopped the medicine, and they flare. So I've seen that a couple times. So it's hard to predict, really. Even if you're a perfect candidate for de-escalation, sometimes it doesn't work out. But then you have to have a backup plan, right? So you have to check the fecal calprotectin every 3 months after stopping and then have an exit strategy. And another thing is there are a lot of people on STD who get better and then they don't want to see a GI anymore. And I just want to encourage you, you still need to see one because you need to get colon cancer screenings. Despite feeling well, you still need to get a colonoscopy every year or two if you've had this disease more than 8 years, depending on the distribution of your disease, to screen for colon cancer, and also need to get screened for osteoporosis. If you've been on steroids for more than 3 months, you need a DEXA scan. You need to get skin cancer screening, and that needs to be done for all patients with inflammatory bowel disease, no matter what medicine you've been on, because there is a little bit of an increased risk of that. And you got to get up to date with your vaccines. Especially when you're on medications, you can be at risk for pneumonia, flu. You pretty much need to get all the recommended vaccines. So those are my thoughts on diet and IBD. You know, my philosophy is evolving over time, but that's where we are right now. So my hope is that if you're considering diet, I definitely encourage you to give it a try, but don't neglect medicine if that's what you need as well. Because the goal with diet is not just to be somebody who can, you know, declare victory over the disease and say, I beat the disease without medication. I mean, that's kind of at a low level. I think the goal should be for you to live a happy, fulfilled life with a good quality of life, and to utilize whatever tools are necessary to get you there. And there, it is possible that some people get stuck in a rut, and they're doing the same thing and not getting the results they need. So I encourage people to be your own advocate, to be a scientist, to be objective, and don't follow things like their religion or gospel, but you need to find what's going to work for you, or what combination of things are going to work for you. And then that's going to be your prescription for success. Thank you.